Welcome to the Birthing Instincts podcast. I'm Dr. Stuart Fishbein, community-based practicing obstetrician and longtime advocate for birth choices.
And I'm Bliss Young, a licensed midwife.
Join us in our conversational style podcast where we talk about everything birth.
Sometimes we laugh, sometimes we cry, but we're happy that you're here. So here we go.
We always start out laughing.
I mean, I guess that's good, right?
It is good. It is good. It's like it's Wednesday morning. It's the craziest morning of the week on social media for us. Stuff comes out. People comment. It's very busy. Plus, I prep for recording.
Here we are. I have to get camera ready.
I don't.
I was thinking about that today as I was doing that.
I'm wearing swag today.
Let me see. Stand up straighter. I only see reteach. I love it.
Oh,
there we go. Yes.
Yeah. It's from our swag shop.
Our swag shop. I love it. Reteach so, breach.
First, before we get too far into it, I have to say a good morning.
Good morning.
Have there been any good middle of the nights for you lately or things have been quiet?
Thank God. Yes. Although I've been staying up way too late. I don't know what's going on with me, but I keep going. This woman is going to go into labor at any moment, and you're going to be sad that you stayed up too late. I'm not taking my own client advice. It's not that I don't want to go to bed. It's just that I can't fall asleep. So there you go.
Yeah.
But no births lately.
Okay. No births. Sleeping has been an issue for me for a long time. I wake up many times in the middle of the night. But the nice thing about it is I know that I don't have to get up in the morning. So
that's right. Isn't that the best when you're like, it doesn't matter?
No, I sleep soundest just before I wake up. It's funny. I guess that's normal though. I think I've heard that's normal.
Mm-hmm. It is.
So I have a couple things. One, I'm going to have to put us on pause for a second because I left my phone in the other room and I wanted to read something that Dr. Joel Warsh put out. So I'll do that. I was scrambling. I have to admit, I was scrambling.
It's okay.
I looked at the clock. It was 11:02. And it's like, whoa, I'm 2 minutes late. I'm never late.
You're never late.
I know I'm never late. So a couple of comedy things, unless you have some things that are really on your mind.
Oh, no, it's been raining a ton here.
Again?
Yeah. I think they said it's been like almost a foot of rain in the last little bit of time here, which is a lot for us. So
it's a lot for anybody.
Yeah.
A foot of rain.
Yeah.
Do we want to thank the cloud seeding people for that?
You can do that.
Okay. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Bill Gates.
I love the rain, but no, you wanted me to read something that one of my clients sent. So you'll just let me know when you think that's a good time.
Oh, okay, well, let's get through some of these intro things first that I have to get off my mind.
Okay.
First of all, I realized that, you know, I drink a lot of water now, that I filtered water that I have this machine, and I take a lot of vitamins in the morning. And sometimes I used to joke about people that took prenatal vitamins have just, all they do is make expensive urine.
Yeah.
So I'm telling you right now, I take 15 supplements in the morning. I'm making the most expensive urine in all of Southern Utah. That's for sure. Okay. I don't know how much of it's actually being absorbed and how much of it's not, but it's just, yeah, I'm trying again. I'm trying to lead a healthier lifestyle. So we'll see what happens.
That's great, Stu.
Okay. Here's a no-no. Don't play with your phone while you're in the bathtub.
Didn't your mama ever tell you that?
No. My mama died before cell phones were I think, available. Aww. Right.
She would have told you that.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, I had my non-ionizing radiation case on my phone. Mm-hmm. So only thing that happened actually was that the plug got water in it and I couldn't charge it for overnight. But
did you put it in rice?
No, it didn't go off. It didn't, nothing. It still worked.
Okay.
I dropped it in like, and I instantly got it out, but it was like submerged and it still worked. So it's something good about that case. A lot of my paper insurance cards and stuff are have seen better days, but that sort of thing. Okay. in the news big time over on the feed that we've been, that most of us who listen to us get, we saw this, you probably saw this too, that there was a gorilla born by a cesarean section.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So of course that's sensationalized. Not the 872 billion gorillas that have been born vaginally since the dawn of time.
No, of course
but
not.
But what I was more impressed about, first of all, it didn't look that premature.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. But what I was sort of curious about was they were saying that the mother was getting preeclampsia. It's like, How did they know?
She was complaining about swelling. And headaches.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. Here we go. Now all animals are going to have cesareans. Here we go.
This is, you know what? I, again, this is a slippery slope thing that happens. This gets publicized. Now all zoos are going to start monitoring their gorillas for preeclampsia and gestational diabetes. I don't know. But what are they taking, a blood pressure on the gorilla? What were they doing? I mean, I guess that zoos have such a high priority on keeping their animals healthy that they can't stop meddling and they can't trust nature. And if a gorilla dies in captivity, maybe it's the captivity that killed them and not necessarily a problem with the pregnancy itself. What were they feeding the gorilla?
Exactly. Enough protein? Probably not.
Not enough.
Oh my gosh. That reminds me. We went to a restaurant yesterday to get lunch, and I ended up getting a burger at this place, but they had like on the bottom that all of their beef was carrot fed. And my boyfriend and I were like, I don't know why you would feed a cow carrots and why we would want all of our cows to be carrot fed when they eat grass.
Yeah. And by the way, are they organic carrots?
We were like, why is that good? I don't know if I want. Anyways.
Well, this is the part of this is the thing that we start to have to really look at when we're being advertised to.
Right.
Because almost all advertising like that is really stupid if you actually break it down and look at it. We won't even go into that. I got so much fun stuff that I want to talk about today.
No, we're not gonna go into stuff. That, but
yeah. Yeah. So why don't you, while I run and get my phone, why don't you tell our listeners what our topic is today? Okay.
Okay. Our topic today is we are going to be talking about laboring down, because this has become a common conversation. It looks like there are studies that have been done long ago, because as we started to look at the deep dive, these are studies from like 2017. But it seems like the trickle down into the hospitals and what care providers are telling their families and what doulas are having to advocate for is this not laboring down because of the consequences. So of course, I'm going to get on my nature is best physiologic soapbox, and Stu is going to break down the actual research.
Yeah, I am.
I forgot for a minute what our topic was. But I got it. I remembered it.
Good stalling. Thank you for stalling. Okay.
You're welcome.
All right. So people know that we had Dr. Gator. What?
Oh, sorry.
No, Dr. Joel Gator. His nickname is Gator. Dr. Joel Walsh.
Yes.
Warsh. Warsh.
Pediatrician.
He makes funny posts, and he has the lowest budget of anybody posting on the internet because he uses a whiteboard and just a marker to make his posts.
Great.
But he did one the other day where he was talking about, he says here, kids need nutritionists and exercise trainers, not Ozempic prescriptions.
Yeah.
And he goes on about, he says, controversial alert, like trigger warning, I guess.
Yeah.
Why are we prescribing Ozempic for our kids when what they really need is a prescription for nutritionist and a pair of sneakers? Why are those not covered? Kids need nutritionists and exercise trainers, not Ozempic. Remember Fen-Phen? Do you remember Fen-Phen?
It was a diet pill. Yeah.
Yeah. And it caused it was a fad that ended up causing all kinds of heart and other issues. Sound familiar? God.
Yeah.
Okay. In our quest for instant solutions, we are forgetting the hard lessons from the past. Fenfen promised quick weight loss, but left a trail of heartache and health issues. Are we on the brink of repeating history with today's quick fixes? Let's get real about what it means to build a healthy foundation for our children. It's time to swap out prescription pads for real sustainable life changes. It's time for insurance to cover the things that promote health. I would argue that I wouldn't wait for insurance to cover it, but insurance should change the way they cover things.
Yeah, and I think that if you have a child who's struggling with weight, you also can do a lot at home. You don't have to like outsource that.
Yes. Correct. I mean, yeah. I think he's in agreement with that too. He's just talking about in general, if they're going to pay for Ozempic, they should be paying for other stuff too.
Totally. 100%.
It's time for us to rally around prevention instead of treatment. Nutrition and physical activity are not just old school, they're gold school standards for a reason. Why opt for a temporary fix when the power of a healthy diet and exercise can rewrite the story of our children's health? Let's challenge the status quo and advocate for our long-term solutions that don't just treat symptoms, but nurture overall well-being. How many times have we talked about the fact that that's what's going on? Because there's no money in keeping people healthy. Of course, medications may be needed at times, and Ozempic is no different. I'm not even sure I agree with that statement. Certain conditions may necessitate using it, but this should be a last resort, not a first, and should be the exemption, not the rule. Your child's health is not a trend. It's time to think long term. And then I commented on that. Hang on a second. Let me see if I can find the comment. Here it is. And I said to Dr. Warsh, I said, and to his followers, think on this. It starts during pregnancy with what moms eat, probably even before pregnancy. Our daily food supply is full of toxins. Fetuses are so vulnerable. Then it continues with how we give birth in our country. Inductions, drugs, cesareans, immediate cord clamping, sterile environment all affect the microbiome. The microbiome affects the gut. We should all know that by now. And the gut flora affects our immune system and how we process what we are fed. Chronic illnesses in children are up. Autoimmune disorders in children are up. Obesity in children is up. Let's look at the root cause and let's restore nature's design. It all starts with pre-pregnancy health to pregnancy and how we give birth. And then I think I talked to you about this and you mentioned about breastfeeding as well. Formula.
Yeah. And formula, they've done a lot of studies about formula can cause obesity later in life. And I noticed the difference in my children, although they do have different genetics as well. But my eldest son, I had to go back to work after 6 weeks because I was a single mom and he had formula and he's definitely struggled as an adult with weight.
Yeah. So, so
about our choices.
It is about the choices we make and things that are forced upon us. And we have to decide not to let things be forced upon us anymore. We have to stand up and say, this doesn't make sense to me. You're not doing, you know, all these people giving you advice. I mean, look at where they've taken us. At some point, you have to wake up and just realize that that your best interest is not their best interest.
And there's no quick fix. Turn off the Instagram. I catch myself knowing that I'm spending too much time on doing things like that rather than writing
or
going to walk. So I have to catch myself. So you catch yourself and don't focus on those things and focus on cooking more meals and spending more time together and going back to the basics because there isn't a quick fix. You know, these things take effort and time and energy and we really need to be thinking about, like you said, going back to the basics.
And don't use your phone in the tub.
PSA.
Okay.
PSA of the day.
Okay. So those of you who have joined our Patreon, we're very grateful for that. For those of you who haven't, I posted a thing about the value of time. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And you got very emotional. It was very sweet.
I did. I got choked up because I read a passage from a book of a man that I knew and made me think about that. Couple things that I got a lot of responses from you and I'm really grateful. And if you wanted to know more about it, you should sign up for our Patreon, watch the video. I think it's about 26 minutes long. And this is the extra content that we'll put in there. But I wanted to just read a couple of the letters because, again, partly because it makes me feel good and it's my show and I get to do that. And partly because it does express the value of time. And then I want to end this little part about time with something that my son sent me yesterday, which I'll talk about in just a second. So this is from Lacey. And Lacey, I want to thank you. And I also want to thank, well, I want to thank all of you, but Lacey and Katie for sending these two beautiful messages. She says, I didn't want to post this publicly, but it is now. But I appreciate that you both did the recent episode on the value of time. To be honest, when you first announced your Patreon, I was like, quote, I am definitely joining to help financially compensate these experts for all the free advice I benefited from. And I've supported some of your sponsors for that same reason. You are professionals who kindly and generously offer your advice and expertise to the world for free. You are certainly right to value your time, your education, your experience, and your well value to the request a private, your value to request a private paid consult for very specific medical questions. Additionally, it seems prudent to do so that your advice is tailored to the person's exact situation, which is certainly most valuable to her. If I'm honest, I have been very surprised that you have addressed so many women's specific medical questions on your podcast, and I personally will be doing a private consult for any that I may have. Heck, even during my initial interview with my doula and my midwife, both offered tons of advice and expertise, so much so that I stopped them to say, quote, I feel like here is where I should be paying you, unquote. Both were so happy to help and decline payment, but they definitely earned it. I guess that's what makes this type of physiologic birth community unique. The providers, including you, are so passionate about what they do, and they are more than happy to go above and beyond without compensation. So in short, thank you for all the free expertise you've both offered, but there is absolutely a time at which you are well justified to request compensation for your services.
Yep. And even when we do request compensation for our services, sometimes how we feel and the kind of work that we do, we end up giving more than we probably should. Not because we should be gatekeepers. It's not about that. It's about our own well-being and sustainability. You know, it's like you think about midwives retire or want to throw their phone in the ocean after a couple of years of being on call. You get midwives who are 10, 15, 20 years into their practice. They're just now starting to really gain some traction in their wisdom and they're done. And so as a community, we really need to make sure that these wise women are able to sustain, or men are able to sustain being able to continue to give information. Because at some point, if you're not feeling acknowledged or compensated, you have to start putting up more boundaries about taking care of yourself. And so it's a symbiotic relationship. And you know, when I read those comments this morning, I was thinking, I didn't even think about Patreon in that way. I thought about Patreon as like, we're going to do something where, you know, we have content that's free, but then we have content that, you know, it's a community and we exchange ideas and information and all of that. But, you know, I realize that is part of the kind of philosophy of Patreon, is to support people who are giving content. So it's like support. We're not the only ones, obviously. There's tons of people providing content on Patreon. But like, I thought about that, what she said about as them supporting us and continuing to do what we do. And it was like, ah, that's a really beautiful exchange. So thank you, Lacey.
Yeah, it's a very mensch-like thing to do. To use a Yiddish word. And mm-hmm. I'll tell you, I've been doing it for a long time. I've never even thought of it. I mean, I've thought of it that way, but it's something that just in passing, like I sign up to a lot of Substacks and I may not even read them most of the time. There's guys like Charles Eisenstein, Alex Berenson, Matt Taibbi, just guys on Substack that I appreciate the fact that they're independent journalists. And a way to support them is to pay $50 a year to support them. And then I get their content. And if I, you know, I don't have time in the day to read it, much of their content anyway, but it's just a way of supporting them. So that was great. So I really appreciate that from Lacey. Bliss, What is Element?
L-M-N-T. It's an amazing sponsor, first of all. We love them so much. But it's a tasty electrolyte drink with all of the good stuff and none of the BS, like
us.
That's right. I taught you well.
It is. It's got a lot of good salts in it and no sugar. I even took a little notes here, and they have 1,000 milligrams of sodium, 200 milligrams of potassium, and 60 milligrams of magnesium, which helps maintain fluid balance, regulates your blood pressure, and supports muscle function, mood, and bone health.
Which is great for pregnant mamas, breastfeeding moms, and absolutely for birth workers. So make sure that you have some in your birth bag if you need it, or if your clients do in labor.
For sure. Electrolyte deficiency or imbalances can cause like headache, cramps, fatigue, and weakness, especially in the birthing world. You know, a long time when we, before when I used to do it, but you still do. You have a lot of sleep after being up all night and snacking on like not such good food sometimes. And I carry it with me whenever I travel, and I add it to my water, like in the hotel room and stuff. And I've spent a lot of time recently in hotel rooms. It's a great sponsor, and they've been doing really well, and I'm really proud to be supporting them. They have multiple flavors.
Your favorite is raspberry, right?
Raspberry is mine, and yours is mango chili. Yeah. But I do have some sad news.
Aww.
So long, old friend, to Lemon Habanero.
Oh, man. They discontinued it?
So they could concentrate on citrus salt, raspberry salt, orange salt, raw unflavored, mango chili, chocolate salt, and watermelon salt. Maybe they're going to come out with some new stuff, too. But I trust Element. I trust that they've done a deep dive into the research. They put their whole soul into it. We would like you to go to Drink Element. That's drinklmnt.com/birthinginstincts, all one word. And when you do that, you'll get a free sample pack with your every order.
Go do it.
Go do it. This is from Katie. Katie, I have to give you credit because even I couldn't do this math. you know what I'm talking about here. Uh-huh. You have roughly 30,330 hours of free podcast content alone.
I love it.
Which doesn't even take into account the countless hours you spent messaging individuals and creating social media content. I think I speak for most in this community when I say there are many people overjoyed to be able to monetarily support you in Bliss because you deserve some compensation for all you've given us. Thanks for what you do, Dr. Stu and Bliss. Right.
Yay.
Okay. So.
And by the way, while we're on the subject of being compensated, I have a friend here locally who we were talking about the podcast, and she said something about making money. And I was like, oh, we don't make money.
We don't.
Every month we divvy it up. And you guys, it's not much. Stu was covering the expenses for gosh, a decade, right? Like you weren't making any money. You were like losing money.
Yeah, for most of the time we didn't even have a sponsor.
Yeah. So just so you guys know, I know it seems like we're doing like all kinds of things, but this is not a moneymaker for us, really. This is a passion project. So just so you know.
Yeah. I mean, Joe Rogan probably makes money and maybe Ben Shapiro, and that's about it. Everybody else loses money.
But we love it. And we love you guys. And you make our lives worthwhile, honestly. We love what we do. We do. That's
so why we laugh. On the same subject of time, this just struck me that my son would send me this for a completely different reason. My son's girlfriend is Jewish, and they're very close. They're probably going to get married. And so he's studying Judaism to possibly convert. All right. And the fact that he's just a really good guy, my son, Andy. And this is from a book called The Sabbath by a man named Abraham Joshua Heschel. I've never heard of him. I don't read this kind of stuff. It's not something that I would normally be looking at. And I'm just going to read this passage. And this one, I probably will not start to cry when I read it. Okay. Goes, we are all infatuated with the splendor of space, with the grandeur of things of space. Thing is a category that lies heavy on our mind, tyrannizing all our thoughts. Our imagination tends to mold all concepts in its image. In our daily lives, we attend primarily to that which the senses are spelling out for us, to what the eyes perceive, to what the fingers touch. Reality to us is thinghood, consisting of substances that occupy space. Even God is conceived by most of us as a thing. The result of our thingness, or thinginess, is our blindness to all reality that fails to identify itself as a thing, as a matter of fact. This is obvious in our understanding of time, which, being thingless and insubstantial, appears to us as if it has no reality. Indeed, we know what to do with space, but we do not know what to do about time, except to make it subservient to space. Most of us seem to labor for the sake of things of space. As a result, we suffer from a deeply rooted dread of time and stand aghast when compelled to look into its face. Time to us is sarcasm, a slick, treacherous monster with a jaw like a furnace incinerating every moment of our lives. Shrinking, therefore, from facing time, we escape for shelter of things of space. The intentions we are unable to carry out, we deposit in space. Possessions become the symbols of our repressions, jubilees of frustration. Is the joy of possession an antidote to the terror of time, which grows to be a dread of inevitable death? Things, when magnified, are forgeries of happiness. It is impossible for a man to shirk the problem of time. The more we think, the more we realize we cannot conquer time through space. We can only master time in time. The higher goal of spiritual living is not to amass a wealth of information, but to face sacred moments. It is in a religious experience, for example, it is not a thing that imposes itself on man, but a spiritual presence. What is retained in the soul is the moment of insight rather than the place where the act came to pass. A moment of insight is a fortune, transporting us beyond the confines of measured time. Spiritual life begins to decay when we fail to sense the grandeur of what is eternal in time. Lastly, our intention here is not to deprecate the world of space, to disparage space and the blessings of things of space, is to disparage the works of creation, the works which God beheld and said, "It was good." Time and space are interrelated. To overlook either of them is to be partially blind. What we plead against is man's unconditional surrender to space. And by space, I'm really talking about material things. I think people get that. His enslavement to things. We must not forget that it is not a thing that lends significance to the moment. It is the moment that lends significance to things.
That is lovely. I'm glad he shared that with you.
Yeah, it's pretty cool to get that from one of your offspring, though, isn't it?
Totally. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Okay. Anything else you want to add before we take a break and come back and talk about laboring doubt?
Do you want me to read this?
Oh, yes. 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 You want
to give it context?
Yes, of course.
No, I said, do you want to give it context?
Oh, no. You do your thing.
Okay.
I've been talking for like 90% of the podcast so far. It's your turn.
So I have had a rough few weeks, to say the least. I have been processing those couple of bursts that I've shared with you guys, and you know, just really up against, I think it's too deep for me to get into all of it right now, but I think that there are times from talking to other midwives in the cycle of what we do that we go through these periods of times where we're like, do I really want to continue to do this? Is it really sustainable? Am I really giving, you know, what I want to give? Am I receiving back something in return that feels valuable for me? Or am I devoting my entire life to something and feeling depleted? And I think that that's an important thing that we all need to reflect on. And it's funny, one of the chats with the midwives were saying, equating it to like a abusive relationship. Midwifery, because we have these times where we're like, that's it, I'm out, I'm quitting, I'm leaving, I'm not doing it anymore. And then we have these beautiful births and we're like, oh my God, this is the best thing I've ever done in my life. So it's like a cycle. So they were kind of encouraging me to maybe take a break from taking more challenging cases for a while and just doing the easier ones right now because I think my cup needs to be filled up. But I was exchanging messages with one of my past clients to get milk donations for one of my present clients. And we were just kind of like catching up. And she said, I want to share something with you. And it ended up being to me what I would call like a God shot. So it's like, or the universe kind of rising up and giving you a nod to say, you're on the right track, keep going. And so this is it. I shared it with Dr. Stu and he wanted me to read it. Yes. Did you want to say something?
Yeah. That's why I wanted you to introduce it because nobody talks as beautifully as you do. And when you sent this to me yesterday and I read it, I mean, I actually was totally speechless. I was in awe of the fact that someone can write like this.
Right.
To me, this is Tolkien-esque. This is this is the language of I don't know, of beautiful fiction writers of the past, even though this isn't fiction, but just the way she used the language. So I hope that people listening will just stop, turn off the noise, sit still for a second, let Bliss read this to you, and we'll talk about it after. Go.
Okay. I wrote a little something about you in my diary after Kay's birth. Went something like, she's a shadow worker, a woman who walks the path with life and death, both friend and foe. And there she was, hunched over my son's non-moving, breathing body, breathing life into him. I wondered, did she impart a piece of her soul into him? Would he breathe with the fire in his belly like she has in hers? And his first breath being borrowed from her, did some alchemy, magic, energy transference just happen? In giving life to him, did he in turn give life to her? When you give breath to a new baby, does the new baby give breath and beat to the giver's heart and soul? As I watched my son's chest rise and fall, I wonder if she knows that she walks the fine line of this world and the spirit world, and she does it like a spear of fire atop a deep, still lake. I wonder how many lives she will give breath and life to. Will death be kind to her when it is her time? Is God watching the angelic work she does? Is she an angel with amnesia? Does she know that she brings souls earthside through a portal? And that this calling, this work is God's work? She must be an angel with amnesia, for how else can a human being give the breath of life to another unless they are vessels of the Creator? The most beautiful memory I will cherish of her is this, the breath of life she gave to me through my son. For she didn't just save him and bring him through the portal, she saved me. Her breath activated within me a current of energy that will stay with me until I leave this world. The kiss of life. I imagine that's what the Big Bang was like, the universe breathing life into the cosmos.
I don't know how you got through that. I could never have read that.
And this is the depth of the work that I really do. You know, this is the work that I really do. And to be seen and recognized. And this is one of my, I'm not going to talk about who it was. I told her it would be anonymous, but this is one of the ones that I really fought for and it was really challenging. And so for her to be able to reflect back on that and recognize that we did deep, deep work together it's one of those acknowledgments of the soul, you know, like I don't need kudos. I just need to know that my life is, I'm giving my life to things that are worthy.
Well, I hear what you're saying. I think we all need kudos. It just depends on, you know, where it comes from. Does it come from inner self or does it come from exterior? It was nice getting those letters that I got. This sort of letter is for me, life affirming, to know that, because a lot of our listeners have been in situations where we've done stuff like this. And most of the time, you're never acknowledged for it. You have to take it in, and you don't need the acknowledgement. The acknowledgement is knowing that you're going home and knowing that you did a great job and that this is what you're calling for. you know, that I've always said that, you know, as an obstetrician, I didn't go to medical school and residency for 8 years to do pap smears. Okay. I did it for the occasional instance that you just described, or the, you know, the emergency surgery that I would have done to save somebody, or the cancer surgery or something. That's why you do it. And sometimes you get acknowledged, and I, you know, I have a thing hanging on my wall, not behind me because you can't read it. It's too small. That says it's from a patient who just says two sentences or one sentence, quite simply, "Thank you for saving my life." And that's what it says. And yeah. Okay. I'm spent. I'm done. Yeah. That was really a moving, one of the most moving things I've ever heard.
Thank you for encouraging me to read it today.
And, yeah. And the use of language. Again, nobody writes like that anymore.
I don't know. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So what did you find out for us?
On what?
On laboring down, whatever the heck that means. Does that happen in nature? Yeah, sure. It does. Laboring down happens. We don't have a name for it. What it looks like when you have physiologic birth is that, as Dr. Stu described, I think it was last week when we were talking with Alex and you were talking about the things that you learned from midwives, is like what we notice is a shift in the way that she is coping with labor, the sounds that she's making, and then that guttural pushing sound. And, you know, it doesn't always happen. I've had it before where we're waiting for 9-10 hours for that shit to happen. But in the majority, you don't need to check and decide that you're going to tell this woman to push. She follows her body's instinct. And from my perspective as a midwife, this is the safest way. This is the best way for our perineum and our pelvic floor. This is the best thing for our baby's transition. This is the best thing for our bleeding. And so this whole thing about like whether or not to labor down, I know that we need to talk about what's happening in the majority of births, because the majority of them are happening in the hospital. But for me, it's frustrating because I know that most of that is totally unnecessary.
To get back to the mammalian world and stuff like that, nobody's coaching any animal how to push. Some will probably push differently than others. You know, I just watched a triplet deer birth on the internet. I don't know if any of you saw that. Global Midwife 64 has it on her Instagram page. You can probably find it. But it wasn't sent to me by her, but she's obviously the triplet whisperer now. So, and you just watch the mom. She's busy licking one of her babies. And then when she gets a surge, she sort of just stops for a second and bears down a little bit. And she's not grimacing or grunting. There's absolutely no sound coming from her. But you can see her abdomen contract and stuff like that. So she, nature knows what to do. And sometimes if you get the urge, you're going to push. And sometimes what I'm going to talk about, a lot of it is when you have epidural anesthesia, and then what happens, because you've lost all the signals.
Yeah.
So let me start by reading a direct message from Deanne. I think it's from Instagram. It says, "Can we talk about the 2018 quote research unquote?" So she gets it. ACOG statement about laboring down. They're saying it's not recommended and problematic for the perineum, even if the baby is at zero station. They're claiming if a woman is complete to begin pushing, even if baby is higher up. This doesn't make sense to me, but getting some pushback from hospital staff when suggesting a mother be given a little more time to have the baby move down a little. That's the end of that. Yeah. So,
and a lot, you know, having been a doula for many years in the hospital, you know, what ends up and my own personal experience of pushing for 6 hours, what ends up happening is, if you're pushing before there's a natural instinct, you are going to be pushing for a long time and exhausting yourself and exhausting the baby. So, and then, you know, hospital policies often will have a cap. Well, that's too long, so it's time to go in and have a C-section. So it seems really counterintuitive.
Okay. So before I comment and we summarize and we talk about, you and I have a dialogue about it. Let's see what ACOG committee opinion number 766 from, I think it's February of 2019 is when it came out. And it's titled Approaches to Limit Intervention During Labor and Birth. So this was probably completely ignored by most hospitals and doctors. It's one of those clinical opinions that they probably decided to ignore as opposed to ones that they tend to follow immediately. All right. So just because of the title, because this was, what, 3.5 years ago?
Right. Actually,
4 years ago. No, 5 years ago. 2019 was 5 years ago. Holy moly. Right. Approaches to limit intervention during labor and birth. Have any of these, has anything changed really? Okay. So this is interesting because, and again, it's a deep dive, but this is what I do. And then you can chime in anytime.
Yeah.
So I went right to the section that said second stage of labor pushing technique. And it says obstetrician gynecologists and other obstetric care providers in the United States often encourage women to labor to push with a prolonged closed glottis effort, like a Valsalva maneuver during each contraction. However, when not coached to breathe in a specific way, women most often will push with an open glottis. A Cochrane review of 8 randomized controlled trials that compared spontaneous to Valsalva pushing in the second stage of labor found no clear differences in the duration of the second stage, spontaneous vaginal delivery, episiotomy, perineal lacerations, 5-minute Apgar score, less than 7, or neonatal intensive care admissions, or duration of pushing. So in other words, they didn't find any significant difference looking at these trials between actively pushing and then let the women passively laying down, including the length of the second stage, which is interesting.
How many people?
Oh, I don't, these are, there are 8 randomized controlled trials. I don't know how many people were in it, but there's a lot more to it. I'm going to break that down. Okay. So a meta-analysis that included 3 randomized controlled trials of low-risk, nulliparous women at 36 weeks of gestation without epidural anesthesia. So in other words, first-time moms, at term, spontaneous labor, without epidural anesthesia, they found no differences in the rate of operative vaginal delivery, cesarean delivery, episiotomy, or perineal lacerations, whether they actively pushed or they passively pushed. Okay. So one of these randomized control trials found an increased frequency of abnormal urodynamics, which is pelvic floor function, 3 months after giving birth in association with Valsalva pushing. The long-term clinical significance of this finding is uncertain. They only looked at it for 3 months, so they have no idea whether that will just recover or not. However, in consideration of the limited data regarding superiority of spontaneous versus Valsalva pushing, each woman should be encouraged to use her preferred and most effective technique. Okay? Yeah. So, you know, right?
Right.
That's what ACOG says. But right. Then, you know, this Deanne's getting pushback from the hospital because they want to do it their way. They don't want the woman to have the choice to labor down. And again, my feeling is, one, that's just force of habit. That's just what they've always done. It's the way I was taught. Soon as somebody's complete, because we know they're complete because we're doing vaginal exams all the time, even if they can barely feel anything, we have them start pushing, partly because we want to get out of there.
Yep.
Right. We want to move on to the next task. There's no thought as to allowing nature's process to proceed, and maybe there's a benefit to that. So that's what those, let's talk about, now they want to talk about immediate versus delayed pushing for primate women, nulliparous women, with epidural anesthesia. Okay, so the first one was, there was no difference really if they didn't have anesthesia. And again, these are only about primips. There's nothing in this paper at all about multips, which is interesting. So you can extrapolate at that multips, you know, whatever they do, it's going to work faster anyway.
Yeah.
Right, okay. So offering nulliparous women receiving epidural anesthesia a rest period at 10 centimeters dilation before pushing is based on the theory that a rest period allows the fetus to passively rotate and descend while conserving the woman's energy for pushing efforts. That's the theory. But you and I both know that a woman laying on her side or on her back because she's numb from an epidural can't really help her baby rotate and descend. right?
No, but her body can do a lot of that work itself.
Right. But positioning and movement of mother and moving of her pelvis.
That'd be very helpful.
Very helpful. Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
this practice is called delayed pushing, laboring down, or passive descent. The second stage of labor has two phases. And this is an important little thing here because this is about nomenclature. Has two phases. The passive descent of the fetus through the maternal pelvis, and two, the active phase of maternal pushing. Studies that suggest an increased risk of adverse maternal and neonatal outcomes with increasing second stage duration generally do not account for the duration of these passive and active phases. In other words, what that means is the minute someone's completely dilated at a hospital by their 10 centimeters on an unnecessary vaginal exam, okay, they're considered, that's the start of the second stage. Boom. Right. Whether they're pushing or not.
Mm-hmm.
So 2 hours goes by and they've only been pushing for an hour. That may be considered a prolonged second stage when it's really not prolonged.
You know, I'm laughing is because at home, I mean, maybe I'm the only midwife that does this, but I don't think so. My assistant will be like, is it second stage yet? Is the second stage? Are you considering the second stage? Yeah, because I mean, you get those little guttural like sounds, but that's not, we know that's not real pushing yet, you know? So you don't want to chart something too early either, because sometimes with first time moms, there can be a long pushing phase. So I haven't had a 6 hour pushing phase and I can't even tell you 5-6 hours in so long. It just doesn't, even with first time moms, because if they have that instinct, babies usually just come out. So, that's why I was laughing about second stage being at 10 centimeters.
Yeah, if we have time, I have a redemptive VBAC story someplace here on my desk where she pushed for over 6 hours, but that was because she was at home.
Yeah. And, you know, if you look at physiologic birth, it's interesting because I was asked to speak. I won't mention who, but I was asked to speak in a kind of symposium where they're talking about physiologic birth and they want me to give tips on how to have physiologic birth in the hospital. And I'm like, I don't think that that's really possible, because what we're talking about physiologic birth is not actually physiologic birth. So in a home birth where someone's unmedicated and is able to move around and do all the things that they need to do, we have this recognition of these pauses, these natural pauses in labor where, you know, maybe there's like a little bit of a plateau that's normal because the body does need to recoup. So right between transition, so if we're not doing dilation shocks, between transition and pushing, there's often a period of time, it might just be through a couple of contractions, it might be hours, where a woman's body is resting. And we call it the rest and be grateful phase, because you're not having those consistent, intense contractions. And the physical part of pushing your baby out can be like, take a lot of energy and strength. So it's like the body knows, okay, we need to let the uterus relax. We need to let the mom regroup. We need to let the baby regroup. That is a physiologic part of normal birth.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. No, it's, there's more than, there's just more than one way to skin a cat. The medical model just often doesn't accept the fact that they don't. Yeah. Cause they don't know. We weren't taught this.
They don't know.
Okay. Two meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials compared maternal and neonatal outcomes in women assigned to immediate versus delayed pushing have been published. And again, we're talking about the nulliparous woman with an epidural here, okay? Both studies found that delaying pushing for 1 to 2 hours extended the duration of the second stage by a mean of approximately 1 hour and was associated with approximately 20 minutes less active maternal pushing efforts. So in other words, it took longer to get the baby out, but they actually were pushing for a shorter period of time.
Because they're measuring second stage as
completely dilated.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Although both reports noted a significantly increased spontaneous delivery rate, this difference was no longer significant when the analysis was restricted to high quality randomized controlled trials. I don't even know what that really means, but okay. So it goes on. However, a recent large retrospective analysis, again, retrospective data, is probably the lowest quality scientific evidence, was found that delaying pushing by 60 minutes or more was associated with a modest increase in cesarean delivery. Odds ratio 1.86. Operative vaginal delivery, odds ratio 1.26. Again, this is hospital-based systems where they sort of want the baby in the bassinet. Postpartum hemorrhage, odds ratio of 1.43, and transfusion odds ratio of 1.51, but no increase in adverse neonatal outcomes. The study design does not determine causation and was not able to account for important co-founders such as the indications for delayed pushing or fetal station at the onset of the second stage of labor that were addressed by the more recent randomized trial. So this is one way, this is a way one cannot just read an abstract. This is a reason why you cannot just read an abstract. You read an abstract and it's going to say, oh, we found a higher C-section rate in women who have delayed pushing or laboring down. But that's not what the paper concluded. Uh-huh. It's kind of like the headline in a newspaper, and then you read the story, and the actual meat of the story is in the paragraph six, and says the opposite of what the headline said. The headline's there to grab your grab. So be careful, people, when you're reading research papers. Don't read it.
Which goes back to what we were talking about in the very beginning about wanting a quick fix and wanting a pill to fix things. Like, we have to really slow down and stop trying to get our information in quick bites, because we're not getting the full picture.
Yeah. So it says here, a recent 2018 multi-center randomized controlled trial of more than 2,400 nulliparous women receiving epidural anesthesia. This is by Cahill, and I actually have that report, so I'll break that down in just a second. Assigned participants to begin pushing at the start of the second stage, in other words, when they're complete, or to delay pushing for 60 minutes unless the urge or healthcare provider recommendation to push occurred sooner.
I love the labor down for 60 minutes. Still the same bullshit. It's still the same bullshit.
What, that they put a time limit on it?
It's the same thing like when we're in the hospital and they're like, we'll give you 2 more hours to completely dilate. Like, yeah, we're going to get there on an epidural. Give me a break. So.
Right.
Right.
But they work. That's a shift mentality. It's embedded in you from the very beginning. I mean, your very first day of medical school and stuff like that, you start to learn that there are, you know, these guidelines that then become benchmarks for your assessing quality, and they don't know, they're no longer guidelines. Where did I leave off? Okay. The trial was stopped. Okay. Before the intended recruitment was complete because of concern for excess morbidity in the delayed pushing group. No difference in rates of, I don't really know what that is, but let me go on. No differences in rates of spontaneous vaginal bursts were noted even after consideration of fetal station and head position. Women assigned to push at the start of the second stage had lower rates of chorio, postpartum hemorrhage, and neonates had lower risks of acidemia if they began pushing immediately in this one study. Okay. Collectively, and particularly in light of recent high quality study findings, data supporting pushing at the start of the second stage of labor for nulliparous women receiving neural axial analgesia. Data seems to support pushing at the start of the second stage for labor for nulliparous women receiving neural axial analgesia. So whether you're numb or not, this one paper has decided that the data supports pushing immediately. That's what it says. Delayed pushing has not been shown to significantly improve the likelihood of vaginal birth. The risks of delayed pushing, including infection, hemorrhage, and neonatal acidemia, should be shared with a nulliparous woman receiving neural axial analgesia, which is epidural, who considers such an approach, right? So that's that one paper. So let's take a quick peek at that paper. And again, there's no discussion here about multiparous women. This is always about nulliparous women with epidurals. We know, well, we'll get to our analysis in just a second. One last thing. So this paper by Cahill and Associates was designed to use nulliparous women beyond 37 weeks, spontaneous or induced labor with epidural anesthesia. The main outcomes was spontaneous vaginal delivery. Secondary outcomes have included total duration of the second stage, duration of active pushing, operative vaginal delivery, cesarean delivery, postpartum hemorrhage, chorioamnionitis, endometritis, perineal lacerations greater than second degree, and a composite outcome of neonatal morbidity that included neonatal death and 9 other adverse outcomes. You know what I think about composite outcomes. All right. They include death with respiratory assistance or a broken clavicle or whatever. So I'm always suspicious when people use composite morbidity. All right. And they don't describe what the other 9 are. They describe a few of them. But they don't in the abstract. I don't have the article. It's behind a paywall and I wasn't going to pay for this. Sorry. But the results are really interesting. The rate of spontaneous vaginal delivery, which is the primary outcome, was not different, but it was 85.9% in the immediate pushing group and 86.5% in the delayed group. All right, which is not significantly different. So my question, of course, is going to be what, Bliss?
And why do it?
No, it's how did they get such high success rates with vaginal delivery in nulliparous women with an epidural?
Because that's not even equating to the normal standards.
They had C-section rates of 13%.
Yeah.
14%.
Yeah.
So who are these people?
Right.
Right. How does this extrapolate to clinical situations in hospitals that have a 40% C-section rate? So again, this is like trial. They have these ridiculously low numbers for C-section.
Right. So we're already calling bullshit. something smells fishy already.
Yeah. They say there was no significant difference in 5 out of the 9 specified secondary outcomes reported. Again, they don't list what they were in the abstract. So I'm doing what I tell people not to do, and I'm just reading the abstract. But again, I'm just bringing it up because otherwise, yeah, well, it gets too weedy. The immediate group had significantly shorter mean duration of the second stage compared with the delayed group, 102 minutes versus 134 minutes. But they actually pushed longer, 83.7 minutes versus 74.5 minutes. So again, they're timing the second stage from the point you're complete. But if moms are allowed to labor down, they're going to work less to get the baby out, is what these things are saying. Some of the studies say there's more morbidity for that. But odds ratio of 1.6 or something like that doesn't necessarily mean it's that high. It depends what the denominator is, of course. So, you know, and I don't know what the numbers are. They're not listed here. So the conclusions among nulliparous women receiving neuroaxial anesthesia, the timing of secondary stage pushing effects did not affect the rate of spontaneous vaginal delivery. These findings may help inform decisions about the preferred timing of second stage pushing efforts when considered with other maternal and neonatal outcomes. So essentially what they're saying, even after they say that it causes more problems, is that either one of these things is fine. It's the patient's choice. One last thing, it says, the active women pushed longer, but by the standard definition of the second stage of labor, they delivered sooner. No, the active women pushed longer. Oh, and they delivered sooner, but they actually didn't push the passive women or the laboring town women. Sorry, the language. They pushed a shorter amount, but it took longer for the baby to come out
because of where they started second.
Because when they started. Yeah. So what? Like many other things, maybe it's time to change the definition of second stage and clarify that for our obstetrical colleagues.
Yeah.
I mean, they change the definition all the time of so many different things. They're constantly changing the definition of what's IUGR. I don't know. Last week it was this week it's that. Mm-hmm. So let's consider changing it to when a woman starts to push.
Right.
But not just when they're completely dilated, because in a real perfect world, we wouldn't know when a woman is completely dilated.
Right.
All right. So waiting for mom to have the urge is the way that you practice, the way that you midwives have taught me to practice. Talk about it. Where did that come from?
Where did what come from?
Letting a woman labor as nature intended. Where did that come from?
Well, because that's just, I mean, We are there to support the physiologic process. We are there to make sure that to the best of our ability, in the way that we are examining and measuring and evaluating, that we're only stepping in to interfere with the natural process when it's clinically indicated. And sometimes that's not always easy to be able to ascertain because of what we're taught. And if we don't leave birth alone enough, and we don't observe true mammals laboring uninterrupted, we don't know what normal is anymore, because even in the home birth world, we're interfering more often than we need to. But with pushing, I mean, it's pretty across the board, unless someone is getting impatient because they are tired or their practice is too busy or something like that. I think amongst home birth center midwives is, without an epidural, you don't interfere with that process until you have the urge to push. And sometimes we do have outliers. Sometimes we have people who push before they're dilated. And sometimes we have people who are dilated for a long time and never get the urge to push. So there are these outliers that, you know, you have to use your informed decision-making with your clients and with your own clinical interpretations of what to do for those outliers. But the majority of women who are left to move and eat and make sounds and feel free and feel guarded and, you know, that it's a private experience, you're going to hear a shift in the way that they are vocalizing. And that's when we know to kind of gather around. There's no change in what we do at that point usually, but we get closer because we know that she might need more support during this time and that the baby is coming soon. And, you know, as you were reading all of these statistics and all of that stuff, I was also thinking about I brought this up many times when we've talked about studies, because the studies that are being done inside of the medical model. So there's so many cofactors that are not being considered inside of these things. So, you know, sometimes when I take someone to the hospital and they start getting medications and they start getting all these interferences, there are some things that I know that I can still advocate for, but there are certain times when I'm like, there's so much going on now that's outside of the physiologic experience that is now actually needing medical evaluation because we're interfering so much, that sometimes my expertise is not applicable there, you know? And so the fact that there's more chorioamnionitis and there's more hemorrhaging and all of that, how much of that has to do with the things that are being done in the hospital and not about the laboring down process, but because they don't know how to pull those things apart or they can't pull those things apart, it gets extrapolated that that's because we allowed the woman to labor down.
That was brilliant. That was brilliant. You said it better than I was going to say that. Dude, there's so much confusion in how these clients are managed in many different institutions. Everything's different. And you're right. Chorioamnionitis, maybe in a woman that's allowed to labor down, they're having more vaginal exams. Who knows? But these things, again, you can't sort them out. And that's why even trying to read it, my tongue got tied. I got confused. Because it is confusing. And relative risk or odds ratio doesn't mean anything. So the rate of infection is higher in this group, okay? Whether it is or it isn't, or what the cause of that, let's just put that aside for a second and let's just say it's higher. Okay. Well, how high is it?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
If it's one extra woman per 500 or something, is that significant? I mean, obviously it's always significant to the person who has it happen to them, but is that a reason to then intervene in everything? And also, again, this is just another example of how women, when I watch women at home, it's so different in the hospital, because they tell you when they want to push. They tell you they get the urge to push. You're right, some don't, but most do.
Most do.
And we've talked about how epidurals interfere with mother and baby communication. We talked about that on the podcast and in some other podcasts I've been on. But this is just another potential reason why the epidural is not just this godsend, because it takes away the signals and mother's numb. And so she can't feel anything. So often, I mean, what hospitals often do is they'll turn off the epidural, let the epidural wane so that the woman can start feeling again. But during that time that she's numb, it's very hard to push. You can't even control your musculature.
Yep.
So you really can't, you don't have a sense of even what's going on. I've done that. I still remember my days in the hospital where we were having women push. They couldn't do anything. So we put our fingers in their vagina and push down. Do you feel that? Can you feel that? And we'd be you know, massaging back and forth and pushing down, you know, for a long period of time. And oh my gosh, you know, we have more pelvic floor problems and more perineal tears. And who knows what else is going on? And we blame that on the fact that we let them labor down or whatever, when it maybe not has anything to do with that. It may have to do with the epidural anesthesia and the fact that she can't move and she can't feel.
Right, exactly.
Bliss, it's time to talk about one of our favorite sponsors, BirthFit.
Yeah, tell us all about it.
Well, BirthFit is more than just a place where you can exercise. Just like us, they educate our professionals and the general population in the realm of women's health. They are industry leaders in preconception, prenatal, postpartum, and women's fitness. And they have a new program. They have a course in becoming a BirthFit coach. Everything you need to know about BirthFit coach course is there on the BirthFit website. This course is the only holistic, nervous system-focused, functional training certification for those coaching women inside the motherhood transition. That was a mouthful. Why become a BirthFit coach? Well, it can fuel your passion. It can grow your business. It's work-life balance. Be your own boss. Set your own schedule and build a business around your values. Live on a mission. Join a community of coaches on a mission to change the lives of women all over the world. So they also, Bliss, have their great fitness programs. Why don't you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, but that sounds amazing. I think if you guys are working with women to learn from BirthFit and how to integrate the body, can be amazing. But if you're a mama and you are wanting to know how you can best support your body during pregnancy, this is a great place to go. They have a prenatal program, which is 30 days, no equipment needed. And then they have a postpartum package that starts with the lying in program. So often people ask me what they can do in those first few days when they're not really walking yet. And this is a great way to figure out how to start to get back into your body. And then they have a whole postpartum program that is rehabilitating, whether you had a C-section or a vaginal birth. This is a great foundation to getting back into training. So Stu has some great discount codes for you guys, but check them out. We are total fans of the work that they're doing. So,
yeah, and their website is very, very extensive. And so I suggest you go to birthfit.com and scroll through and look at their website. And if you want to sign up for some of the physical fitness courses, you put in the code INSTINCT1 for a discount off their prenatal course and put in the code INSTINCTS2 for a discount off their postpartum course. They have so much to offer. I hope you'll support them because they support us. They're OB and midwife approved.
Yep. So go check them out.
Okay, let's get back to the show.
You know, the other thing I wanted to point out, although this is not the direct intention of that study, is that they talk about that there's no increase in third and fourth degree tears. But there was a study that was done, I think, in France a few years ago that had the opposite findings, where it said that when there was directed pushing versus spontaneous pushing, they found that there was much more of third and fourth degree tears. So I'll find that study and put it in the show notes so that you guys can look at that. But it just shows you, like, when you're looking at these studies, they really are oftentimes wanting to prove or disprove what they set out to in the beginning. And so you have to be able to take it with a grain of salt. And Floor Cruz, Badass Mother Birther, put something on Instagram a few days ago where she talked about that you don't need scientific studies for physiologic birth. It just is. If you leave it alone and you witness it, you learn so much. And that is a big problem with these studies and with the medical industrial complex is that they haven't seen those things. They don't see normal and natural enough to be able to ascertain how to actually support physiologic birth. That's not what's happening in the hospital.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. It's just what makes sense to you, the fellow traveler. And again, I agree with Floor. I mean, it's common. It's what's commonsensical. You know, I've always said you don't need a study to tell you it's safer to cross the street when the light is green than when it's red. You just don't. And and another problem, you know, we talk a lot of problems about the medical system itself and how the whole thing is broken. But another problem is also how people advance themselves in academia. They have to do studies. They have to publish.
Right.
So they have to find things to study.
Right.
Because if they don't make papers, then they don't advance themselves to the in academic positions, which is sort of the goal of most people who choose academia over clinical work or administrative work. They want to advance themselves. And I know they have a true quest for knowledge. The question is, I mean, how motivating can it be to do some of the studies that we've talked about on the podcast before?
Right.
Seriously.
I mean, so many that you, even in the references in that paper, I started to look and I was like, there's so many studies about all of these things over and over and over again, you know? So anyway,
right.
It's not my favorite thing, but I'm glad to sit here and talk about it.
It builds the resume and it builds the CV. And for a lot of people, that's really important. But the question is, does it actually do good? So yeah. It may all be, a lot of research may be all stage one thinking. It's like, I need to do research. And everything that's important has probably already been evaluated. So we have to just find minuscule things to do it. And then, of course, if it doesn't meet the model by which they want to practice, they're going to ignore my research anyway. So this is, it's a very frustrating system.
This is true. This is true.
Yeah.
So what are we talking about? What's our additional content on Patreon today, Stu?
Well, we're going to talk about progesterone support. I think I also wanted to look at the luteal phase, but also for first trimester progesterone support. We got a question about Napro progesterone. I think that's what we're going to talk about today. That's what I've done my deep Patreon dive for. So that's what we'll do.
Great. So join us over there. If you aren't already a member, come and see us live over there and be part of the community.
Go ahead.
Keep going.
Did you want to say anything else about the community?
Nope.
Okay. Yeah, support our sponsors too. Before we quit, since we're a little short today, which is good, I'd like to my podcast used to be 35 minutes. Now they're an hour and a half. But I thought I'd end with this letter from Jessica, which I thought was sort of, it's a tangential thing related to this, but it's a kind of a great VBAC story. So it's a triumphant VBAC story. So if I can finish with this, Jessica says, "Hi, Dr. Stu. I hope this is the kind of emails I get all day long, right? I'm not going to be reading them in the bathtub anymore." Seriously, what a dumbass.
No, you know, not.
I'm multitasking. I was multitasking.
Yeah.
I was bathing. I was scrolling. I was reading. And I was watching the Kings game. I have a TV in my bathroom, which is kind of cool. I didn't put it there. It was here when I bought the house. So that's just, I want people to know. Okay. Even though I think it's great. Yeah, I don't have one in the bedroom.
Good.
You shouldn't. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. Hi, Dr. Stu. I hope this message finds you well. We had a consult back in November, and I'm thrilled to be writing with you with an update. After our chat, I reached out to the midwives you referred me to, and was introduced to an incredible midwife in my area who felt an immediate connection with. My husband and I decided to throw all of our fears and reservations out of the window and follow my intuition to fire my OB and commit to having a home birth and working with her. At 31 weeks pregnant, I canceled my 32-week ultrasound. That probably was done for no reason or ordered for no reason, that I had scheduled and transferred my care to my home birth midwife. The care I received was such a refreshing contrast to the typical medical model. She listened to me and made me feel heard, took time to address any of and all concerns, and treated me like a human being with needs and feelings and not just another patient. Needless to say, I felt so good and confident after each prenatal visit we had, which we like good. To talk about as a very good sign. When you walk out of the office, how do you feel?
She actually listened to me. Can you imagine someone actually listening to you?
and actually having to put that down in paper as if it's something that's rare, right? I know. It's a sad statement. Okay. Fast forward several weeks later, I'm so excited to report that I had a successful VBAC at home. I went into spontaneous labor at 40 weeks and 2 days. It was not an easy labor because my baby was not in the most ideal position. She was ROP, right occiput posterior. I was in labor for a total of 36 hours and pushed for 6 hours and 18 minutes. And that's really, she pushed that long. That was not when she was completely dilated and labored down for 2 hours. No, she pushed that long. The back labor was the worst due to the posterior position, but the doula I had, God bless doulas, was such a pillar of support for me and instrumental in getting me through it. Had I gone to a hospital to labor and have my baby, I most assuredly would have ended up with another cesarean section. She says, actually, unnecessary cesarean section. I don't remember the story of her first, but probably is true. Well, I mean, it is true that there's no way that they would have just given up on her.
Yeah.
They would never let her labor for 36 hours. And then even if they did, they would never let her push that long.
Exactly.
And they would have been scaring her, saying, you know, your uterus is going to get weaker. They're increasing your chance of your uterus dehiscing and rupturing and blah, blah, blah. We need to get this baby out now. You've really done great. You've really given it a good try. Okay. Even though it was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, I wouldn't change a thing. I'm so grateful that my midwife never gave up on me and was 100% on my team every step of the way. She went above and beyond to help me achieve my VBAC. And I'm so very thankful to have birthed a beautiful and healthy baby girl. I came out of the experience mentally stronger and healthier and feel like a better version of myself as a mother was born that day too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Very similar to what the woman said in your letter. Very touching.
Yeah.
And means something. It's so important, and it's just not part of the hospital-based birthing model. Yeah. Accomplishing my VBAC was so redemptive and something I will be proud of and cherish always. And then, of course, thank you for all you do. Your podcast led me on this journey and helped arm me with powerful information and the courage to ask more questions and advocate for myself and my baby. My family and I are better off for it. As Bliss pointed out in one of your podcasts, fear is a thief. She's absolutely right. And I'm so glad I let go and decided to trust.
Warm fuzzies. What a good, nice way to end. Warm fuzzies.
It is. It's a very great way to end. So for those of you who are on our Patreon, we'll have our extra content. So stick around.
See you over there. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Birthing Instincts podcast.
We know that we all lead busy lives, so we are extremely grateful that you give us an hour of your time each week.
If you enjoyed this episode, please share. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast for the latest updates and reviews. To help others join us, you can find Dr. Stu at Birthing Instincts and Bliss at Birthing Bliss Midwifery on Instagram.